We don't want pastors who say, vote for X. We don't want that.
Yes.
But what we do...
Why wouldn't we want to do that?
Because I think that it's A, because the Christian conscience is engaged. So we give the principles, but when it comes to the application of those principles to who to vote for, it's a matter of Christian conscience.
Hello and welcome to Independence, the FIEC podcast for church leaders. Thank you so much for joining us. My name is Adrian Reynolds. I'm the head of national ministries for the FIEC, and it's a privilege to be with you again. And today I'm joined by Simon Calvert. Hello, Simon. Thanks for joining us.
Hello. It's a pleasure.
Simon, you work for the Christian Institute. We can see that just over your shoulder. And it's great that you found time at I know it's a very busy season to come and join us. We appreciate it. You're Deputy Director for the Christian Institute. Just tell us very briefly a little bit about the Christian Institute, how it's serving the church in the UK.
So been around since 1991. We write to about 60,000 homes and churches across the UK. Those are our in-touch supporters. We have a staff of 52. We are helping the church to get to grips with some of the hot potato issues, some of the issues that are of most concern to Christians. Not all the issues, but issues that we think are really important. And we're helping the church to get to grips with biblical teaching, but also helping them to understand what the world is saying and how to talk to the world outside the doors of the church about these issues. And for that reason, we also have a strong emphasis on working in politics. We work in all of the parliaments across the UK, and also we do a fair bit of media work. So, looking into a camera or sitting in a radio station and trying to talk about some of these hot potato issues from a distinctively Christian perspective.
Great. And we can see that you're there in the professional studio. I'm here in my amateur setup. That's the difference between us. You said you've got 60,000 on your mailing list.
Yeah.
That's made up of 59,999. And Adrian, long been on that list and very grateful for all you do. You know, not only the stuff we see up front, but I know there's a lot of things that go on behind the scenes. And we're very grateful for that. And probably a good point just to pause. We're going to talk about the general election. That's obviously the pressing matter. But it's a good point just to pause and give thanks to God and recognise really the influence of Colin Hart, who died a few weeks ago, and his memorial service was last week. Tell us how did that go, Simon?
Yeah, so Colin was the founding director of the Christian Institute from 1991. I joined him here in 1996. So I've known him and worked with him for nearly three decades. And he died very suddenly in March. Mm. And it's... Yeah, we're still trying to come to terms with that. But it speaks really well of Colin that he never wanted this to be a personality-focused organization. He always used to joke that he'd had a charisma bypass. That was his way of speaking about it. But he believed very much in training people, in sharing strong convictions and big ideas. And what it meant was that although he died very suddenly, the organization has been able to continue almost seamlessly as far as our supporters are concerned. We have a great team here. But, I think of him every day. We sit in prayer meetings and his voice isn't there. We had a trustees meeting recently, and the idea of an entire trustees meeting without Colin, it's very difficult. So his funeral in March, we had 300 people turn up to his funeral here in Newcastle. We wanted to hold an event in London for those who couldn't make the funeral. So 150 people turned up last week to All Souls Langham Place and listened to eulogies from our acting director, Kieran Kelly, and also from Lyndon Bowring, the chairman of CARE, who was a great friend of Colin and mine and the Christian Institute, especially in the beginning, and also several of our trustees preaching and leading and praying. Mm. And that was a very God-centered event, which is what Colin would have wanted it to be.
Well, fitting then and honouring to the Lord who he served so wonderfully, and we thank God for him. And of course, the work goes on, and it's a very pressing time, isn't it? We're in the middle of a general election campaign. As we record this and as it goes out, just 2 weeks away from a general election called, caught some people on the hop, I guess. But just to reflect on that before we get into the detail, I think we can grumble quite easily, can't we, Simon? I know I look into my heart, I see a lot of grumbling and a lot of reflection on things are not the way I would wish them to be, obviously, as a Christian. But there's a lot to be thankful for in terms of this UK democracy and UK politics. I know it's not without its challenges and faults, but there are also things to be thankful for, aren't there? We should be grateful to God for the relative stability and stuff that we enjoy in the UK.
Yes, no, that is right. I mean, government is part of God's common grace provision for the whole world. I mean, Romans 13 speaks really quite strongly about this idea that God has established.
Yeah, surprisingly strongly to some people.
That's right. Yeah. And I mean, and of course, the Apostle Paul, when he's writing those words to the church at Rome, I mean, they're experiencing immense persecution. And yet he's still able to speak about the authorities being established for our good. And then, you know, we're encouraged, Paul, when he writes to Timothy, first of all, he says, pray for everyone, kings and those in authority. So, I mean, I do wonder, you know, in our churches, in our family worship, is praying for those in authority a priority in the way that Paul seems to suggest? No, the state has an important role in God's economy. And I mean, I find this difficult just not to get sort of swept along with the cynicism. And especially, you know, when, of course, as Christians, we look and we can see faults and flaws with our government that, that non-Christians can't. Yeah. But at the same time, you know, as Christians, we live in this tension of being in a world that has fallen on the one hand, but in which God is still at work by his common grace. And there's so much that's good, so much that's beautiful, so much that's true, so much that, that does basically work, so much that benefits and blesses all people. And, you know, that reflects the goodness and the generosity of our God. I think Acts 14, when the apostle, I think it is, and where is he? I forget. And he's talks about a God doing good to all, filling your hearts with gladness and providing you with food. It pleases God to do good things for a world that rejects him. And so we can be thankful for good government. And again, in relative terms, the situation in the UK is much better than it is in many, many other countries. And there were people watching this who have lived in other countries, who have been missionaries, and they will know that in those countries, they would long for the kind of stability that we have. That's they would right. long for That's the right. kind of freedoms that we have.
So as we're leading our churches in prayer for the election, for example, as we're talking to people pastorally, we do want that to be a theme, don't we? We want thankfulness to be a theme, I think. And we want to be realistic, of course, but that doesn't mean we have to be grumblers and cynics. I think those things are, you know, quite ugly. But realistic, yes, but not grumbling and cynical complainers. I think that's really important. And I appreciate Christian Institute for setting the tone on that. I think it's really important. So it is a privilege to vote. It's a privilege to be part of that. How can we as church leaders, you know, here I am, Simon, you know, I'm a church leader in a kind of small to medium sized church. Variety of people in the church, some of whom are engaged in politics, very keen, enthusiastic, some of whom couldn't even tell you the name of the MP, probably, I imagine, some of whom probably, some of the youngsters maybe not even registered to vote. How do I communicate to them the privilege and the position that we're in as Christians, being able to vote in a general election?
Well, one way of thinking about it is where Christ says, you know, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's and render to God the things that are God's. I mean, again, he's strongly underscoring the legitimate, you know, valid role of government. Now, clearly, Caesar was a dictator. You didn't get to choose him.
No.
But in a democracy, we effectively get to choose who Caesar is going to be. That seems to me, I mean, and in a sense, it's been said, and I think there's some truth in this, that at election time, collectively, the electorate is Caesar. So if we think about it, if we accept it in those terms, it is an especial responsibility to vote. And even just pragmatically, the fact that people fought and died for our freedom to vote and to choose our leaders, that we don't live under a dictatorship. I think to honor their memory and to value, you know, what they've passed down to us. And, you know, it is imperfect. And the famous saying, I think attributed to Winston Churchill, that democracy is the worst way that we've found of governing ourselves apart from all the other options. And so, but I think voting is a responsibility, not just an opportunity. And I think particularly for us as Christians, as we think about our obligation to be salt and light, I think surely that extends to participating in the public square, participating in the way that we are governed.
That's really helpful, thank you. And I like that because that's a very positive view, isn't it, of our responsibility. Jesus isn't saying in that passage, you know, pay your taxes, but do it very reluctantly, just because you have to. There's no sense in the Bible, is there, of a boring, dull, reluctant Christian duty. You know, duty is a joy. It's part of serving the Lord in the world he's made. And so actually that helps us think very positively about politics. Even if we might have a negative view of certain politicians and the world of politics as distinct from the world of governing, I suppose, we should still be very thankful and positive and engaged. That's really helpful.
Yeah, and also I think Christian realism is important because the tendency of the world is either to just write off all politics and all politicians and just say, you know, plague on all your houses, or to idolize politicians, to put them on a pedestal. And a lot of people have been through that scenario of think, oh, my guy's won, it's great, everything from here on is just going to be marvelous. And then he, she lets you down, and then you experience the sort of sense of betrayal. I don't think as Christians we need to go through that because, I mean, you know, for example, I think it's the Psalm 146, maybe, put not your trust in princes.
It is 146, that's right, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's important. We don't put our trust in leaders in the way that we put our trust in God. We don't expect our MP or the Prime Minister or First Minister to be a great saviour figure, whereas many people do. And I think just a slight excursus, but you know, a lot of people in the world, politics is ultimate for them because they don't know God. Politics is everything. It is ultimate. And this explains why some people can be so obsessed about it, why they can be so aggressive about it, why they can be so emotional, you know, positively and negatively about it. Whereas politics shouldn't be ultimate, and it certainly shouldn't be ultimate to us. Mm. But it is, as I say, an opportunity for us to do good. You know, if God in his common grace does good to all by giving us government, then we should, in a sense, cooperate with God in that process by trying to do our little bit to try and make sure that that government is a bit better than it might have been.
This is really helpful because I think what I'm beginning to hear from you, and I'm understanding in local church life, I'm happy to pay the duffer pastor. And so let me do that. You know, what I'm understanding about church life is actually the teaching of theological principles, worldview, grounding, is really essential. We have a right view of humanity, a right view of sin, for example, that allows us to be realistic about our politicians, a right view of common grace. We rejoice in what they're able to do, but we're also realistic about the fact they are fallen people living in a fallen world.
Exactly.
And actually, I think so often as pastors, we teach the application without the grounding principles. And of course, we do want to teach application. That's really important. But actually, if we're not giving people the foundational principles, we won't enable them to think biblically and think wisely. And actually, when it comes to choosing, that's really important. I mean, that's voting. Choosing, that's a difficult, I find that a difficult thing. You look at the parties. I think, you know, there's not a Christian party espousing Christian values. There are bits and pieces here and there. And perhaps some vestiges of a Christian worldview, some policies I like, some policies I don't like. So I feel conflicted about all of that, you know, mixed up. So I've got to have some good Christian principles, haven't I? And I think as a pastor, I've got to teach good Christian principles to enable people to think biblically.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, this is an opportunity that comes around every several years for our congregations, and they need to have some biblical principle to help them to know how to engage with it. I mean, if I can just, I 100% agree with you about the importance of teaching, and I'm grateful for those teachers, pastors, and I know that you're one of them. You're not the duffer pastor, you know, who do try and give Christians some guidance on this. We don't want pastors who say, vote for X. We don't want that.
Yes.
But what we do.
You're not allowed to do, can you, you're sort of verging into slightly dodgy territory if you do that, aren't you? If you use your position to persuade people.
There is an ancient law, well, it's actually not that ancient, Victorian probably, which says that if you use the threat of hellfire to try and persuade somebody to vote this way or that way, you are actually committing an offence. I think that's still on the statute book.
Well, my local mayor was convicted of that in Tower Hamlets.
Yes.
Yes, look right. for ramen.
Yeah.
Yeah, anyway.
So there, you go. There we are. So, yes. Yeah, and we wouldn't want to do that, would we? I mean, as I say, I wouldn't want to...
Why wouldn't we want to do that?
Because I think that, because the Christian conscience is engaged. So we give the principles, but when it comes to the application of those principles to who to vote for, it's a matter of Christian conscience.
Right.
I think, secondly, because we are realistic, the moment you say, you know, vote for X, you are building into the equation the time, a day or a week or a year down the line, where that person or party X lets you down and you've hitched your wagon to them. Mm. You've also got the kind of complexity that person or party X might be good on abortion, but they might be terrible on marriage and divorce or something. And so are you, you know, people want to know, are you endorsing all of them? I just think the pulpit is not the place to be preaching loyalty to a particular party or candidate. Because I think there's just, it gives people the opportunity to say that you're tying the gospel to a particular party. And I just think that can be very unhelpful. I mean, the great Spurgeon, of course, was known for having the Liberal Prime Minister, Gladstone, I think, you know, in his pulpit and stuff. I mean, Spurgeon's great for many things, but I couldn't go with him, you know, that far on that. But to come to your point about teaching, so... we talked about Colin. I'm grateful to you for the chance to mention Colin. One of Colin's great heroes when he was setting up the Christian Institute was Harry Blamires, who died in 2017. Harry Blamires was a student of C.S. Lewis, and he was a great Christian apologist. And he wrote in 1965 a book called The Christian Mind. This is an ancient embattled copy that Colin obtained.
There we go, yeah.
The Christian Mind by Harry Blamires. And what Harry talks about is the way in which, as Christians, we can be functionally secular. And he has this phrase, and he talks about how we go to church and we think Christianly about our worship and prayer. But then he says, when we talk politics with a politician or labor relations with a unionist or healthcare with the healthcare worker, we are functionally secular and we dispense with a Christian mind. And so he was very strong. I remember when I joined the organization in 96, just finding this an absolute revelation that we can have confidence as Christians to be able to speak to the world outside the doors of the church about things that they are interested in and to speak in a distinctively Christian way. And I think that really is in the DNA of the Christian Institute. And so, what he says is you have this, this clash of worldviews, and we have to be alive to that. We have to recognize the way in which the world is trying to squeeze us into its mold. And, you know, the fact that whenever you turn on a news bulletin, that news bulletin will never acknowledge the existence of God, let alone his sovereignty over mankind. So it is inherently secular. Now, I'm not saying that we shouldn't watch news. That's not my point. My point is just being alert to the fact that we are being given a secular view of the world all the time. And in order to counter that, we need to be, strengthening our consciences with Christian teaching to help us think in a distinctively Christian way about these things. So I think that's so important. So when it comes to choosing, we need to be governed by, God's sovereignty, that the fact that R.C. Sproul used to say there isn't one rogue molecule in the universe. Everything is under God's control.
It's a lovely idea, isn't it?
It is a lovely idea. Everything is in God's hands, including our rulers. Proverbs, again, it says the heart of the king is like a watercourse in the hands of the Lord. He directs it whichever way he wishes. So the idea that a king, a powerful ruler in that time, a dictator, can still be moved in his course by God. That's really important. And that gives us kind of fuel for our prayers. So when we do come to 1 Timothy 2 and praying for rulers, we can pray believing that God can actually change the directions of government. But in terms of our choosing, we have to prioritize the things that Scripture prioritizes. We have to be able to recognize where there are Christian biblical absolutes that apply, where there are Christian wisdom issues that apply, and then just where there are, good faith, honest disagreements between Christians. And we have to not fall out over, the kind of the tertiary stuff or even the secondary stuff.
Can we just come back to that in a moment? I find this really hard because it's complicated. It's complex, isn't it? There are those kind of key issues that we can look at, but still you find yourself as you look across the parties setting one against the other very often. I think we need to prepare people for some complexity. There aren't often clear cut answers, are there? And person A may come to a different viewpoint from person B, because actually there are these, maybe there are three or four really key issues, but actually someone might rank them 1, 2, 3, 4, someone else might rank them 4, 3, 2, 1.
Yeah. So,
I mean, I find that complexity somewhat overwhelming, Simon. Am I mistaken to do that, or is that just the reality of life?
I think that is the reality of life. But I mean, I want to say that there are some issues that I believe as Bible-believing Christians that we have to prioritize. So the free proclamation of the gospel. If a government, if a parliament is proposing to do something which would prevent the church from doing its job, that ought to be a first order issue for us.
We've not heard much about that this election campaign, unless I'm missing that.
No, and this is one of the things. And Christians say, well, none of the parties are really strong on that, so kind of what's the point? Well, the point is we need to get them thinking about them. During COVID, one of the reasons why the government found it so easy just to close churches down was that we weren't even part of the discussion. We hadn't done our own thinking about it, and we hadn't, represented those views to government. So we were blindsided, and they were, religiously illiterate. I think it's very important that, we are part of the conversation, and I think that is a primary issue. And then another primary issue will be life. I mean, the Bible says, you shall not murder. So we can't support abortion. We can't support euthanasia.
Beginning and end of life issues come in there, don't they?
Exactly. Yeah. So I think we have to be able to pray. And marriage too. Christ said, for this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be united to his wife. So one man, one woman for life. So it means we can't support same-sex marriage. We can't support divorce laws, which trivialize the process of divorce. We can't support gender ideology. So I think there are some priority issues in there which help to give some clarity. But to your point, the application of that has to be, of course, carefully thought about. None of us is advocating a theonomy, a theocracy. But what we are advocating is that we, having, as it were, sensitized our own consciences by the word of God, seek to sensitize the consciences of people outside the church. Yeah, and given that, as Romans says, the moral law is written on the hearts, people's consciences now accusing, now even defending them. So sometimes they make the right choice. There is a role for us to seeking to sensitize people's consciences to help them make the right choice.
Yeah. But just briefly, Simon, how do we help people post the election when people will have come to different conclusions? We believe in unity in the church, which doesn't mean uniformity. There will be some differing views. People come from different backgrounds, have different stories. How do we keep people together in church on the issue of politics? Where, there might be some people on July the 5th who are extraordinarily happy, others who are extraordinarily disappointed, others who are indifferent.
Yeah. But
give us some tips for us as pastors, how we maintain unity through that. I mean, it must be key to keep proclaiming the sovereignty of God.
Yeah,
that must be part of it. But how do we actually help people relate to one another well?
So I think one tip is don't expect other people to feel the same way about things as you do. I think that's something that people find difficult, is when You know, so if you're unhappy with the election result and you say, oh, isn't it terrible? And you just speak to other people whose political convictions you don't know about. And that kind of makes them feel uncomfortable. They have to kind of either go along with you in your sadness or actually say, well, you know, I take a different view. And similarly, you know, if you're jubilant on election day. So I think just recognizing that other Christians, you know, will have come to different conclusions from you about how to use their vote. And again, I think that's part of the prioritizing, is that we prioritize the issues that really matter. And then, you know, on other issues, I mean, you know, what is the correct level of taxation? You know, how do we best fund the NHS? Well, you know, what about student debt? I mean, you know,
so as Christians, we can come to a view on those things, can't we?
Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
It's not that we're neutral on these things. We can come to a Christian view on those as well.
Yes. Sorry. Yes. For forcing me to clarify. Yes, we do. But what I'm saying is, I think in terms of if we're going to disagree with another Christian, I think it should be on kind of first order issues where the Bible is very, very clear. And on other things, we have to have the grace to take a different view. And I think disagreeing well, I think we can model that to the world. I mean, I've been looking at, I've had on my wall for years, just some of the Bible verses about how to speak to people. So the Apostle Peter says, you know, be prepared to give an answer. And this is in the context of hostility to our faith.
Yeah, yeah.
But do it with gentleness and respect. You look at Philippians, I think it's 4 verse 3. Let your reasonableness be known to all. I'm not sure I've ever heard a sermon on that, but that sounds like a good thing to think about. And then you know, you look at the Proverbs again, and it talks about sweetness of speech, judicious speech, persuasive speech.
Yeah.
And then there's this great verse that says that with patience, a ruler can be persuaded, and a soft tongue can break a bone. So that's speaking about the power of persuasion, but gentle persuasion. And again, in the current climate, where a lot of people think that the way to persuade people in politics is to say, you are stupid or you are a hateful bigot. That's not, you know,
we've got to show a better way, haven't we?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's really helpful, just as we come to an end, because we can speak to one another. That's also true. You know, there's a lot in Ephesians, isn't there, about how we speak to one another. And there are some good principles there. I'm always struck there are 127 proverbs on speech, which I like. It's a little stat I like to have up my sleeve.
I think
it's extraordinary,
that.
Really. And how we speak to one another really matters.
Yeah.
But actually how we speak of others and to others outside the church, as you're hinting there, that really matters. We can speak into these situations, but we need to do it in a way that's Christian. That's basically what we're saying, isn't it?
Yeah.
And those principles don't just apply to general election time.
Yeah.
They apply to all time, don't they?
Yeah, because, I mean, we believe that everyone is an image bearer of God. And again, I think it's, you know, James who speaks to that in terms of the power of the tongue and
right.
the way in which we can tear down other people. But no, because of the people are made in the image of God, we need to speak to them as such, that we recognize their inherent dignity. And that also means, and this is one of my pet themes, if you'll forgive me for cramming it in, but, you know, being able to work with people.
No, go on, Simon, go on.
Being able to work with people with whom you profoundly disagree. You know, every vote that we've ever won in Parliament over the years, we've won by working with non-Christians and persuading non-Christians. And you can forge some unlikely co-belligerencies and even some unlikely friendships. You know, I've ended up over the years working closely with the then head of the National Secular Society. We disagreed about so many things, but there were a few things that we agreed on because his conscience was informed by the moral law, because, you know, we recognized one another's sort of fundamental human dignity, because we sort of built a relationship of trust and honesty. You know, a friendship kind of grew out of that. And so no matter how bad, you know, you might think your new MP is, look out for those occasions where she or he says it as the right thing, and you could write a thank you letter to them, or, you know, you might be able to forge a relationship with them working on that one thing.
Yes, I that would be a great thing. I mean, I know a few MPs, and I wonder how many of them get complimentary post. But most of their post bag, I imagine, is about things that are going wrong or complaints. So what a wonderful witness when you see someone doing something that's good to commend them for it. I think that's that's a great thing to do, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Listen, Simon, we're out of time. Thank you so much for joining us. And there's lots of resources on the Christian Institute website. I know I've had some of them in the post as well. We'll put a link in the show notes so that people can see a link through.
Yeah.
And some really helpful stuff. There you go. There's the election briefing 2024.
So coming to the post, I suppose, this week and available online. It's a great resource.
Thank you very much. And by the time you're listening to this podcast, too late to register to vote. Actually, the day we're recording it today, which is Tuesday the 18th, that's the deadline. So if you haven't registered to vote, it might be too late. But there's always next time around. And actually, I mean, the general election is significant, but all elections, you know, people are less engaged, aren't they, in local elections and what have you. But actually, those are just as important in terms of how our lives are governed. So thank you so much, Simon. You've given us a real vision for how we should be engaged in the world, but not of it, recognizing it for what it is, recognizing its limitations, but also giving thanks to God for the security and the peace and the prosperity we do enjoy. You know, you're right. It's been dubbed the year of elections, hasn't it, 2024? Mm. And as we look around and see some of the elections that have been happening, you know, whether that's in Russia or in India or in some of these other places where actually there's extraordinary challenge, let's say, we should be thankful for what we have. And, and you've really helped us with that, Simon. So thank you very much.
It's been great to talk to you. Thanks for the invitation.
Thank you, Simon. Bless you. And thank you for joining us too. If you've enjoyed the podcast, please do rate and review it because it helps other people find it. And we'll catch up with you soon. Thank you very much.